Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Skylines is brought to you by 100 Resilient Cities. Pioneered by the Rockefeller Foundation, 100 Resilient Cities is dedicated to helping cities around the world become more resilient to the physical, social, and economic challenges of the growing part of the 21st century. You can find out more at its website, 100resilientcities.org.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hello and welcome to Skylines, the City Metric podcast. I'm Stephanie.
And I'm John. And this week, it's our birthday. I've been doing this a whole year now. You came in halfway through, but you've done more than half of them. So, you know, it's been a whole year. This is episode 30. There's a lot of this stuff by now, is what I'm saying. If you, for some strange reason, wanted to listen to the entirety of Skylines back to back, it will keep you going for about 24 hours and you come out the other end a bit odd.
We accept no liability if anyone goes and does it.
Don't do that.
So, John, it's our birthday. How are we celebrating?
So, you know the way on, like, anniversary specials of TV shows, they get the old cast back?
Yeah.
You know that's a thing?
Mm.
Hi, Barbara. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm back from the dead.
You are?
Which is nice. I had 6 months in the ground.
How are the dead?
Yeah, it's pretty good. Different to here, but best not to think about that now that I'm safely back in the City Metric bunker.
which is obviously
where we spend all our time,
which is your happy place, I assume.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'm just going to go ahead and assume that you miss us all terribly. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, we should talk about your actual happy place.
Real happy place,
which is how do you even describe it? What is it?
High Street bakery chain Greggs.
Yes.
I'm surprised you didn't already know that, John. It almost makes me think you haven't done your research for this segment or to be my friend.
Okay, so the reason we're going to talk about Greggs is, other than the fact that we all clearly have issues, is that you wrote a piece for us a while ago with a headline along the lines of what this map of every branch of Greggs in the UK tells us about the High Street. I didn't ask you to do this. I'm not sure anyone asked you to do this. It just appeared one day.
No, I definitely framed it as a response to popular demand, whether that was true or not. I found the map for my own purposes and tweeted it, and then people came back with some quite funny and interesting questions. So I decided that it was time for the world to have a long, long piece about Greggs and its business model. And so I wrote it.
What were the things that surprised you most about the distribution of Greggs?
So there's many things, Stephanie. I'm glad you asked. One thing, which is probably slightly predictable, which is that there's very, very few branches in Devon and Cornwall, which lots of people noticed on Twitter. And Greggs were a bit cagey about answering this, and in fact, all of my questions, because I think they thought I was completely mad. And they kind of didn't really say why. They said they might open some in Devon, but definitely not Cornwall. But the answer is obvious, which is that in the home of the Cornish pasty, Greggs's square bakes probably wouldn't go down that well. I think the market's really cornered around there.
Before we move on from that, I would like to know what's better, a Cornish pasty or a Greggs square bake?
Oh,
is
don't
that
you?
A joke?
Oh, you're gonna get her killed.
Is that a joke? I mean, for me, there's no competition. Let's put it that way. A square bake, obviously. It's a perfect shape.
Well, I hope you'll have a lovely time on your holiday in Newquay this year.
Yeah, no, I don't intend to go, and there aren't any Greggs there, so it wouldn't be much of a holiday. Another thing that was interesting is that people kept sending me news of something called a second-hand Greggs, which is the kind of red Greggs.
That sounds horrible.
As opposed to the traditional blue, where they sell sort of day-old pastries. But it's less horrible when you know that they do cook everything, albeit sometimes from frozen, freshly on the Greggs premises. So a one-day-old Greggs pastry is quite different from a one-day-old something in a supermarket.
I just feel like second-hand is probably not the best name for that, because that makes it sound like...
Used Greggs.
Yes.
Pre-loved Greggs.
There's like a particularly grim picture I was sent of the second-hand Greggs in Barry, in Wales, sort of down the road from the normal Greggs, and it doesn't look like a very cheerful place. But you know, we shouldn't judge.
I also have some questions about the idea that everything is freshly cooked from frozen. I mean, that's not what the word fresh means.
Well, it kind of does. I mean, that makes it fresher than something that you baked from bread and then had 2 days later, because that is the point of freezing food, no?
I like the way you're genuinely a little bit offended by that question.
Yeah, I'm quite angry, yeah. I mean, well, also, especially because Greggs has recently launched a range of frozen bakes in Iceland, which you can go and buy and make them even fresher in your own home.
Can I ask a couple of questions? Firstly, I feel like maybe we should row back and explain a little bit of the character of Greggs for our international audience who maybe will not have had the pleasure of going to a Greggs. Why do you love Greggs so much? And what is Greggs apart from...
The reason I think it's really good for anyone, even if they're not me, is that I think there's a problem at the moment where you've got tons and tons of very sort of fancy-ish lunch places on the high street, which are like Pret or Itsu, and where you're kind of spending the same as you might on a dinner out for lunch for hot food, and then you've got horrible supermarket sandwiches, and there's not a lot in between. And I went there when I was working in a shop, and you wanted to have something warm for lunch that wasn't going to cost you like your whole day's wages, and it is fresh, John, and it's like warm and it's nice and it's not kind of terrible for you. I mean, like, people have eaten pasties for lunch for a long time. It's kind of the similar idea, and it's quite kind of comforting. It's not, if you're not in the mood for an Itsu salmon platter for £10, instead you can get delicious meat and cheese in a pastry wrapper for less than £2.
Which I guess brings me to my second question, which is, what is your relationship with Greggs now? Because I know you and the public relations department of Greggs have got beef, if you'll excuse the pun.
Oh, I don't think that's true. They're just not as responsive to my status as their number one fan as I would imagine that they would be. Well, the worst thing, actually, about my recent departure from the City Metric podcast and, secondarily, my job, is that my new job, there isn't a Greggs anywhere because I now work in Kensington, so it does look like this was a bad career move from that point of view. But I would still go there because also, I mean, this is a very controversial thing, but they've recently moved into much healthier foods and you can basically get most things you could get in Pret there for about half the price, which I also think is a very good selling point. As I have developed, so has Greggs.
Is there such a thing as a Greggs salad?
Yes. It's just like a normal salad.
It's not like it doesn't come in like pastry or something, because that's not a salad.
No, they do normal salads. They do, if you've ever been to Pret and seen a very weird thing called a protein pot, which is spinach and a hard-boiled egg, they do those in Greggs, which is quite outrageous copying of Pret, but there you go.
I ate those when I was on the blood sugar diet, where you have to have something ludicrous like 700 calories a day, and that was the only way of not keeling over about 6 p.m. was to eat a couple of hard-boiled eggs and some spinach.
700 calories is not enough calories a day. I think we should take you down to Greggs right now to redress this period of your life.
I mean, the difficulty is that I do not generally have difficulties that involve consuming too few calories. This is not a problem to which I am prone. So this was a radical departure, and it worked. It, like, not only did I lose a load of weight really quickly, but actually when I fell off the diet and started eating crap again, it stayed off for a surprisingly long time. So it does do something weird to your metabolism.
Well, you'll be glad to hear that Greggs also has some bakes now which are like 300 calories.
That's still, I mean, that's not an insubstantial number of calories. That's not like amazing.
For a pastry based,
I mean, yeah, for
meal,
something pastry, I mean, based.
Yeah, you can get a sandwich for a lot more than that.
You could have one of those for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and you're still on kind of extreme.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good suggestion, Stephanie. Thank you. If any of you do attempt this, please let us know. And
also,
we'll be happy to chronicle your journey.
Yeah, we accept no responsibility for any damage you might do to your health doing
Please do not follow any of the diets discussed in this podcast, whatever you do. So you pitch this article as, you know, what does it tell us about the British High Street? I think that was probably a trick to get me to publish it. But nonetheless, I'm going to ask you, you know, tell me, what did it teach us about British High Street?
Well, the biggest fact in this map, which is sort of slightly hidden, is the fact that there are a huge number of Greggs. There's like verging on 2,000 branches of Greggs, which for context, there's about 800 branches of Starbucks in this country. So people really like it. They keep opening and they keep not shutting down again. So the first thing you can learn is that people want that. The thing that I described before about having something that's hot and doesn't feel like it's come out of a packet but isn't really expensive is hugely popular. There are a lot more branches in the north. Northern cities tend to have like 10 in like a very small radius. And there's just seems to be this huge demand for quite kind of traditional foods done kind of cheaply but fairly well. They are actually a British company. Their kind of ethical stuff is kind of slightly better than you might assume. It's just a very straightforward company that has loads of shops and that people really like.
So where do you think it kind of fits into the sort of socioeconomic scale? What's the profile of a Greggs? Like, compare it to a Pret or a Percy.
It's sort of the normal working person, I would say. If you're a lawyer, you're probably not spending a lot of time in Greggs. If you work doing kind of phone care for customers, you probably go to Greggs quite a lot, I would say. And I think, again, the profile of the cities where it's much bigger. In London, there's actually a relatively small number of Greggs considering the number of people here. So, yeah, it is the northern cities. But it's that thing where you don't want... It's people who didn't want to bring, like, a sad sandwich, but they also don't want to go and blow all their money in Pret. And they want to have a small, nice treat for themselves.
Mm. Pret, we should explain for the international listeners, is it's kind of a slightly posher sandwich shop. Which there are Prets in the US now, which is kind of...
Yeah, they have been for quite a long time.
I think it was a British company. But, you know, I got quite excited when I was in Washington, D.C. last April and there was a Pret. So yeah. I went to and had the same thing I would have had at home, because that's the problem with these chains. They get inside your brain.
This is the other thing I would say about the profile of a Greggs customer. I don't think Greggs would do very well abroad. I think it is quite a British thing. And it's almost a sort of school dinners. There's something about it, of food that kind of isn't horrible but isn't fancy. And is just kind of quite straightforward and almost quite childish, which I think British people really respond to.
I associate it with gravy. I don't like... It's
not
the
sure
same
they even
kind
do
of,
gravy.
No, but it's the same kind of... It's the
yeah.
same kind of comfort food. Is
yeah,
that,
exactly. Like, and it's like the idea of a steak bake, I think a lot of British people would like, and a lot of people would probably be like, that just looks horrible. Like, what is that brown mush inside that pastry? Mm. But we love them.
So... This has been kind of a growing phenomenon for basically all our lifetimes, but just like all high streets increasingly look exactly the same now. And you can wander around any British town and it feels weirdly familiar because it's the same shops in slightly different order. It's like, you know, the way in cartoons the background repeats. It's kind of like that. So where do we stand on that? Are we happy with that?
It's tricky, yeah. I mean, I suppose the question is whether you think things like Greggs are pushing out like independent sandwich shops, which is possible. I think the problem is that any chain manages to get lower price points and really good kind of distribution networks set up, and once you have that many branches of something, you can do it pretty well in all different places. But I can see the argument that there's probably less of a space for a kind of a cheap deli or something on a lot of high streets because of a place like this. But then I think it's worse that places like Pret and Itsu and all those other places are pushing out those same places and charging an absolute fortune.
I think there is sometimes a tendency to... It feels sort of risky to go to a completely independent place, a place you don't know, because, like, you don't know what it's going to be like. It's probably going to be wonderful a lot of the time, but I think there is often kind of an urge to go to the familiar brand where you know what you're going to get.
And sort of speed and convenience as well. Like, I mean, a lot of these places do mark themselves as being very quick. And, again, Greggs is quick and kind of... hot food at the same time, which is quite a good selling point. Even places like Lyon kind of market themselves as healthy but fast food, because they can, again, the increasingly on high streets, what you're actually getting is not necessarily shoppers but people who live and work around the area and kind of want to eat on the go.
Well, I think it's time to ask the big question. Barbara, what is your favourite item from Greggs?
My favourite item has always been a chicken bake, which again I think is like the epitome of comfort food. It is completely and totally beige. If anything, just off-white, off-white all the way through. If you've ever had chunky chicken from M&S, it's basically that in pastry. So that is a very nice comfort food. So I sometimes will get the sausage, bean and cheese melt, which is more colourful. So it's a bit riskier as a proposition, but they're both great. And you can hold them in your hand and eat them as you walk along, which again, I think is a great.
This has turned feature. Much more into free advertising than I was expecting. Well, I'd forgotten how you were genuinely quite sort of crazy about Greggs.
Yeah, I am not sponsored by Greggs, and Greggs have given me nothing. My colleague gave me a Greggs lip balm that she got sent by Greggs, but Greggs had no interest in sending one to me. So yeah, I'm getting nothing in return for this at all. But yeah, we haven't mentioned a very important feature of our Greggs journey, which is that Stephanie found on Amazon. Ian Gregg, the founder of Greggs, has wrote a book called Bread, the Story of Greggs, which is a lot harder to say than it sounds. It's quite sweet. Each chapter has like a recipe for a kind of a good British cake or bake, and he kind of explains why he thinks it's still doing as well as it is, which is that perhaps customers identify with a business that still retains old-fashioned values, that seems local rather than global, and doesn't put shareholders before customers and staff. So in answer to your earlier point, John, I guess the fact that it's not an international brand might also make people feel a bit better.
Can I ask, are there any regional variations in how Greggs runs? I.e., do you have, you know, in Greggs in Yorkshire, you can get different food and they call it a balm in other parts of the country. I'm just thinking if there are some brands where you kind of go to Scotland and they do sell different food items there. Or
as far as I know, Greggs has a very kind of narrow and consistent range of products. I think that probably works best for them in terms of scaling up across the country. It might be that there's variations. If any of you know of any listeners, do let us know. But I think that they have a huge kind of research department which goes into just kind of working on fine-tuning a small number of recipes, which means there's a guy who's basically, his job title is like the director of cake, so that's obviously what I'm angling for with my long-term interest in this company.
I find that very interesting, because I think regional food is something that is going to become less and less part of our lives as we kind of move from a generation that has grown up with very homogenised high streets. Because I remember going to an independent baker's as a child, and I don't know how much my brothers and sisters, they're kind of 10 years younger, I don't know how much they would have done that. It's that idea of kind of going, this is something which is just cooked and produced in this area. I think, is that becoming less of a thing?
I think it is, but there's an element of, I suppose the shift is that this idea of kind of British food is still around, but maybe the regional thing is disappearing, and that Greggs can market itself as British, but I don't think does see the value in bothering. But I think you would have Ecclesgates, you'd have a bit of everything rather than specialising according to where you were.
I mean, I find it interesting / depressing that there's not really a British cuisine in the way there's an Italian one or a French one. Like there's isolated British or English or Scottish or whatever dishes, but there's not really this kind of whole sort of food system.
I don't know. I think that's maybe something of, I don't think it's entirely a myth, and partially just because the food history of Britain is so related to international trade. So we have always, for instance, British food has used spices for much longer than people think it has. You know, spiced meat and spiced vegetables has been around for a long time, but definitely I think boiling rather than frying. Meats, stews and soups are very British.
Pastry,
potatoes.
I suppose what I'm getting at is you're not going to walk into a city almost anywhere in the world and find an English restaurant. That's just not a thing.
No, and I think that is the fact that our food culture has always been relatively global because of the history of colonisation. But actually, I don't know, I think in America you do, although it's selling itself on something.
But I think it's also because around kind of food status, high status foods and people in Britain have always been fairly international. And I think that the food that you do think of as quite British is kind of thought of as a bit sludgy and working class and a bit Greggs-like, really. Like, you're not going to go into a restaurant and order a pasty, although you have tons of convenience stores and stuff really that would sell that.
Yeah, I suppose the ruling classes have always been much more interesting in what they're serving in Versailles.
Exactly, French food is what you'd have if you were wealthy in Britain.
Another thing is that food, exports best when it is high on complexity and low on ingredient quality. And British food is generally not very complex. You won't have like a Mexican mole sauce where there's 90 ingredients in, which is actually relatively easy to export because you can use the dried versions. And what makes it good is the work you put into it. Nobody's going to bother growing turnips in the middle of Japan, which is what that's kind of what you need to make British food. British
sending
is
Bubble
it.
And Squeak over to Russia.
Oh, but Bubble and Squeak is so good. They must have a version of that everywhere anyway.
Yeah, I think in Eastern Europe it's all along those,
it's all
along those lines anyway. Yeah.
If Mexican food is so complex, why is it that whatever you order it tastes the same? It's what I've never understood about. I'm going to get letters about that. But this is like, it's the
same. Maybe you should go to like better Mexican restaurants.
Or Mexico. Not like that at all. Really.
Or like, it's completely different. Or like any part of the southern United States.
No, I've been to Mexican restaurants in the States run by actual Mexicans and not like, you know, Taco Bell. I mean, like, you know, good ones. And it's still like, feels like the same eight ingredients remixed slightly. But I'm going to get hate mail for this, aren't I?
So is your point that if they can manage that, then our incredibly limited British diet of like potatoes and meat stews should be more celebrated around the world than it is? So I agree with you.
Do you know the theory that the European colonialism can be credited entirely to the potato? You heard this one?
Nope.
No.
I love this nerd stuff. This is in like a book called 1493, The Author of... which escapes me, but never mind, you can look that up. Basically, until the potato arrived in Europe, in Northern Europe, everyone was starving the whole time because it was just really difficult to kind of get enough calories out of, like, the turnip was the previous staple, and the potato suddenly means that, you know, people aren't starving to death half the time, and therefore it's possible to sort of send people out on ships to kick crap out of other countries around the world.
So. Also, they stop you getting scurvy because they actually have a huge amount of vitamin C, potatoes.
So, to sum up, eat potatoes, eat more than 800 calories a day, and don't be too nice about greys because they'll think you're weird.
I live to tell the tale.
What does the lip balm smell of?
It's a festive bake scented lip balm, so it tastes of the herbs which are sprinkled atop the festive bake, which I would guess are thyme and rosemary. It's actually a very nice lip balm.
See, that's really a classic British lip balm.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. I only buy any British. And by that I mean I only buy any Greggs.
So there is actually someone else who's been very involved with Skylines from the beginning who you probably won't be that aware of. It's our producer, Royful Brown, who, you know, since it's our birthday, it would be nice to get him on as well. So, Royful.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're kind of you're a bit of a mysterious figure on this podcast. You produce most episodes, but you've only appeared once pretty briefly.
You know what, John? I produce the good ones.
You produce the best produced ones, certainly. I think we can definitely agree on that one, that you're a better podcast producer than I am. But yeah, I think probably what a lot of people listening don't realise, because I've never really talked about it, is that without you, we wouldn't be here at all. I mean, it was kind of your idea in the first place. Like, I'd considered doing a podcast, but it was only when you kind of came to me and said, I really think there's a gap in the market and I think I can help you do that, that I actually got my stuff together to make it happen. So, you know, well done. Here we are a year on. How have you found the last year of Skylines?
I kind of love being a part of it. And I think you slightly overplay my role in all of this because CT Metric was a thing and a great thing online. And basically it was my inherent utter laziness after saying I was going to write an article about my hometown of Birmingham. And then I didn't do it. And you said, Geezy, you actually going to write this article? And I went, yeah, but why don't we do a podcast? And you said, well, I was kind of thinking about doing that, that the whole thing kind of came about. So it wasn't that it was my idea. It's just that you kind of had it in the back of your noggin and I just was just desperate to do it, really. So here we are.
Yeah. But I mean, I wouldn't have got it together to do it without a bit of a push from you, I think. So, you know, thank you for doing that. But
that's all right.
I mean, I think the first email you ever sent me included the memorable line, I am passionately devoted to the future of Birmingham, which is the article that you promised to write me and never did. So should we talk about that?
I am a proud son of Birmingham and I can bore on about Birmingham because, full disclosure, I left Birmingham for the first time 1988 when I went away to college. I've had two forays back in the early 90s, but really I left to go back to London in the mid 1990s. There was a period between, let's say, 1999 and 2004, and I'd go back to Birmingham and there'd be new roads. And we're not talking about new roads in the outer skirts of Birmingham, we're talking about in the city centre. And I had always kind of railed against the town planning disaster that is my hometown. And I'm a committed podcaster and a committed urbanist. And I live part of my year in San Francisco. I live in London and whatever. And it's hard not to compare and contrast those two major cities with my hometown. And about 18 months ago, I was going to do a podcast, which was going to be entitled Birmingham is Crap, Let's Make It Better. Did some research on Birmingham and was actually shocked to discover that as late as the early 1970s, the kind of GDP of Birmingham was actually higher than London. You know, the average Brummie was richer than your average Londoner. And
I knew it went into decline much later than the northern cities because of the car industry. I didn't realize it was actually higher than London.
And when you think about it, places like Wolverhampton, as late as the mid 1960s, were still richer than London. It shows you how bottom heavy, how London centric the UK economy has become quite relatively recently. That after the wave of industrialization, you know, your Manchesters, your Birminghams, your Liverpools, etc., were independently wealthy. But what happened to Birmingham, my hometown, was that in the 1950s, there was a government diktat that cities were a bad thing. It's a case of rebuilding after the Second World War. And there was a deliberate move to depopulate London and Birmingham because cities were seen as being dank and whatever, and the car was going to be the future. And because Birmingham was so rich and forward looking, and on our city motto it says the word forward, and our kind of credo is the city of a thousand trades, we embraced this future, the future of the car, with gusto, and tore down massive swathes of the city, depopulated it by at least 150,000, deliberately made the city centre much smaller because we didn't want industry to go there. And industry was actually told not to, strategic bits of industry, not to locate to Birmingham. So all the way through my childhood, the 70s and the 80s, you had a Birmingham which wasn't really historically Birmingham. It was small, inward looking, and though I don't think it ever went into absolute decline, Birmingham's growth in terms of population and definitely economically was in relative decline. And then by the early 1980s, the southeast of the UK, specifically London, and with the financial sector, just boomed and went straight past Birmingham.
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about the role of the car industry, because late last year I was in Coventry, which is technically a separate city to Birmingham, but it's kind of in its orbit. It's a city of like 400,000 that's also a commuter suburb of Birmingham, really, and which is famous for having had this glorious medieval town centre that was demolished by the Luftwaffe in the war. It just bombed to hell. Mm-hmm. Except a guy from the council planning department who I met when I was up there told me that that's actually a bit of a myth, and it was actually Coventry Council that started knocking it all down in the 1930s to build bloody roads, because, you know, it was a big car manufacturing town and they just thought this is the future. It's a bit embarrassing that we've got all these sort of narrow medieval winding streets. What we really want is a big four-lane highways for the centre.
Birmingham was very similar. I was always told growing up that Birmingham city centre was also bombed, but it wasn't. You know, of course there was some bombing, but no, we didn't have an iconic cathedral to bomb and then just leave a husk of a shell of it like Coventry. But it was exactly the same thing that's basically happened in Birmingham, that because we were so forward looking, and you could completely understand it, you know, they are trying to, the city council are trying to get rid of slums in places like Lee Bank, which were right in the city centre, which the programme Peaky Blinders was kind of really kind of set in kind of Lee Bank and also kind of Small Hoo. So they're trying to clear all these slums. They've got the excuse of a little bit of war damage, but also we're just this really bullish city. So they said, well, the car is the future. And then they looked to America and said, well, you know, this is the future. Let's go copy that. But it wasn't just that happened. It was a case of strategically industry was discouraged from actually going there. And just to kind of understand how rich economically and diverse Birmingham was is to understand that Birmingham is going to be a majority minority city, in that there are more people of black and brown skin than there are white people. And the reason why that happened is because the immigrants came in the 50s and 60s, because there were so many jobs in Birmingham. Birmingham was so rich, you know, so it kind of shows that kind of knock-on effect. But anyway, by the late 1980s, the city council kind of realised that the city centre was absolutely a disaster and looks like a scale electric racing track, with literally motorways bisecting it and a motorway ring road around the city centre, which was restricting the city core actually from growing. The first thing that they kind of did was to build the convention centre and then to upscale Broad Street, which is this main arterial route into the city, which was a dusty kind of no man's land, which is full of kind of furniture shops, kind of semi-run down. And within literally 18 months to 2 years, it became the entertainment highway into the city of Birmingham, connecting the city core to the kind of prosperous west of Birmingham kind of Hagley Road. And it happened so fast.
I honestly didn't realize that was a recent thing, because, you know, I just know Broad Street as kind of the entertainment district.
No, that is early 1990s. And one of the things that the city council did, which was very good to help put Broad Street on the map, was it got Ronnie Scott's to open up a second Ronnie Scott's. Obviously, the Ronnie Scott's is a famous kind of jazz club in Soho, to open up a branch actually on Broad Street, and subsidised it massively for at least 10 years. And then it finally did close down by 2000. But it worked. And then off the back of that, there was a Brindley Place redevelopment, and then the canals were more massively cleaned up. But this is just 20 odd years. You know, the council did that right, but strategically where they've gone wrong, it's always kind of what I call kind of top-down development. So you have on Broad Street, you have the most expensive library in Western Europe, and we can't afford books for it. Architecturally, it's deliberately supposed to be controversial. the council has spent so much money on this building. Then we have the National Indoor Arena, where gladiators used to happen. We have the International Convention Centre. You know when a town is fundamentally small when it needs to rename everything as international. and that's what we have, you know, in Birmingham. You know, it's the second biggest city in the UK and the second biggest by some way. But we still suffer from this mentality that we have to tell people how big Birmingham is. But the development is always, as I said, kind of top down, led by the council, as opposed to them rezoning areas and letting in smaller developers, smaller retailers actually come in and to create a unique kind of character for the city centre. And ring roads are being knocked down and be made smaller so that the city actually works on a pedestrian level. The one thing that everybody notices about going to Birmingham for the first time is that you can't easily walk the city. There are lots of things happening in Birmingham, but you cannot for the life of you give anybody directions of how to get from one area of the city centre to another. And it's something which the City Council, only in, I think, about the last 2 years, have actually really become aware of, and to know that if you want a pedestrian city, you want a city that lives and breathes on a foot level, people need to be able to kind of navigate that. And I was kind of blown away by the plans for basically Digbeth and Southside. All the things which I've always said is that all these developments are always kind of top down. It's a case of let's build the biggest skyscraper, let's build the biggest indoor shopping centre, all these things which we have in Birmingham. They've actually kind of turned that completely on its head. And down by Digbeth, which is the industrial bit of the city centre, which kind of abuts the Bullring Shopping Centre, it's a whole sea of kind of semi-used kind of factory spaces that it's absolutely ripe for redevelopment, but small organic redevelopment. You know, what you don't want is a big developer coming in saying, well, we're going to knock down three blocks of this and then build a great big new shopping centre. And because of HS2, the high speed rail link, which is supposed to come from London to Birmingham, the old Curzon Street train station is going to be reopened, and that hasn't been opened since the early 1900s. They're going to physically move the shopping centre core of Birmingham south by about a quarter of a mile, make one of the large roads into the city centre much smaller. Instead of it being a four-lane highway, it's going to be two lanes, so it's going to be pedestrian friendly, create a clear line of sight so you can actually see the rotunda as a pedestrian when you come out of the train station. But then they're just encouraging small-scale organic development in all of these old kind of factory-fronted businesses, which is it. So it's kind of like, if you imagine London, it's going to be a little bit like Shoreditch abutted next to Oxford Street. And that's just incredibly exciting. There's a disused aqueduct which runs through Digbeth, and they're going to do a skyline. So what you have in New York, so you'll be able to walk along that and actually have great commanding views of the city centre. And I saw these plans, John, and I was actually bowled over that we have a city council who, for the first time in 50 years, are actually doing all the right things in terms of city's development, making the city human again, and actually really putting Birmingham back to where it was, which is actually one of the quietly most vibrant bits actually of the UK.
Before we go, there are two annoying questions I want to ask you. One is, if Birmingham's so great, then why is it that Manchester's the city that gets all the attention?
Our industrial history is much more complicated. Number one, we're physically slightly too close to London. We're not quite far enough away. The identity of the north, whether it's Yorkshire or Lancashire, is much more imprinted onto this history of industrial Britain in a way that the Midlands isn't. Birmingham really came into its prime in the late 19th century. So we're not really associated with mill owners, etc., in the way that kind of Manchester and Yorkshire is. And also, our industrial diversity actually was our strength. We weren't a one-trick pony. We're not Liverpool the docks. We're not Manchester Mills. We actually built cars. We had petrochemical industries. We had jewellery. We had guns. I think something like half of the guns for the American Civil War were actually created in the city of Birmingham. We had a gun quarter, a jewellery quarter. We had all these different quarters. So it's hard for people to pin a specific kind of manufacturing industry to the city of Birmingham. And we managed to kind of like then be this beating heart of the UK, but without an easily recognisable industry to pin us on. You know, Newcastle would have been coal. You know, we didn't have that. We did everything in Birmingham. So that, in a nutshell, is the reason.
The other question I have is, if it's so great, when are you going to move back?
I'm having a wobble. I'm having a wobble. I just think that, you know, sod's law, my luck, but I managed to be born in and have my and grow up in the time when Birmingham actually wasn't great. If I'd been born 20 years beforehand, I actually would have seen an amazing city centre, an amazingly vibrant, forward-looking city. And when I look and when I go to Birmingham now, you can absolutely see the resurgence of Birmingham. So I just have to be born and brought up in the wrong times. But, you know, never say never.
I'm sure your mother will be delighted to hear that.
So because John's idea of how we should celebrate the podcast is do more podcasts, we also...
It's my Ribena berry noise there.
Nobody outside a very certain age range from Britain is going to get that joke.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Did I tell you I went to college with a Milky Bar kid, by the way?
No, you didn't.
No, he went mad. He turned out to be quite weird. Yeah, he went mad and disappeared.
Do you think... Wait, disappeared? What?
Oh, and the reason that's attached in my mind is because I think he was also the noise of the Ribena berry that goes, woo! This is not helping us celebrate our birthday. We should, anyway.
No, but these are all questions I'm going to ask you after recording. And I think if you want to know the story, you should tweet it, John, and he should have to tell it to us all. But because, you know, we sort of need other ways to celebrate except for recording podcasts, which we're going to keep doing anyway. So it's not so much a celebration as just a continuation.
It's about my pathetic need for public adoration is what it really is.
That's at John Elledge on Twitter, guys. We thought we'd ask you guys what we should do for our first birthday.
So, yeah, we asked, how should we mark this momentous anniversary? Simon Alvey, in what is pretty transparent, suggested that we send each of the listeners some cake and a balloon. He just wants cake. That's
not... See, Alex Ingram also went down the cake route, but he thinks we should make a map of cakes. So I'm guessing that is where different cakes are from. That sounds quite cool.
I mean, I don't know what he's talking about there, to be honest. It's just maps and cakes.
But then, I asked, shouldn't we do like a cake in the shape of a map? And then he said, a cake that is a map of cakes, which sounds incredible, but also more work than either of us are.
You know, on City Metric's first birthday, like the website rather than the podcast, because, you know, I've been doing this self-indulgent stuff for a while now, but someone, when I tweeted that it was our first birthday at the website, someone superimposed a piece of cake onto a map of London to see what it would look like, because that was a thing I was doing a lot of at the time, was like, here's a map of Paris on top of a map of London, and like someone did it with cake. You probably had to be there, to be honest.
How big was the cake? Wouldn't it just be really small and you couldn't even
it was
see
about
it
4 miles wide,
right? Okay.
It was at that scale, yeah.
Okay, because like if you just superimpose a picture of a cake on a map of London, it's just an arrow pointing that goes, cake is here.
Yeah. But, I mean, it was a giant.
It was a very big cake. Okay, I feel like I should have opened with that.
Should we get back to the tweets?
We should, because there's a great one from @AngrySai, perennial funny person of the internet, who says, make John apologise to the nun. This is a brilliant, very important callback.
She's been really angry about that story about me and the nun. She's tweeted about this a lot. I mean, she's from a Catholic country, so I think it offended.
I asked for forgiveness for you at Mass on Sunday.
Your boyfriend suggests we do a special episode of the Battle of Stalingrad, which I think he might be comparing me to Mark Corrigan from Peep Show there, so I'm a bit offended.
I don't watch Peep Show, but he definitely does make Peep Show references that I don't understand, so I mean, he might
I think he's calling me a nerd, is what's going on. Connor is calling me a nerd.
I don't think he would call you a nerd.
I think that's what's happening.
Wait, are you calling him a nerd?
Bit of a nerd.
He's not a nerd.
Different kind of nerd.
What's he a nerd about?
We'll talk about this later.
We definitely will. Ah, another suggestion from Angry Sai, who has picked up on another way in which you are a nerd. Get special guest Daniel Hannan on. Dressed as a nun.
We're not getting Daniel Hannan.
Dressed as a nun.
We're not allowing Daniel. I'm not.
Daniel Hannan.
I think he probably Daniel wouldn't want to be in the same room as me.
Daniel Hannan, but it's a nun.
Oh, right. I didn't get the pun there. So it's the Daniel Hannan pun.
Daniel Hannan.
Yeah.
It's Daniel Hannan, but he's dressed as a nun. Your two greatest fears come together as one. Sorry, that rhymed.
Jack Thompson suggests that we travel from one end of the UK to the other using only local... That's quite a sensible suggestion, but that's quite a boring one that I slightly regret reading out. So, very good idea, Jack, but try and be funny next time.
I would like to do that, but I don't think we have either the time or the money. Resources. And also, local transport is very bad in the UK.
I think that's what he's getting at. I think it's like the Gonzo piece.
Village Metric, a whole episode based on tiny parish issues like the funding for new park benches by Rob Fuller. I actually like this because we have a campaign at the moment in New Cross to keep the post office open, and I have a lot of feelings about it.
Are you saying that you want to abuse your City Metric podium to argue to keep the...
Yep, I'm just going to bring a load of NIMBYism to City Metric.
Anne Siegfried Refsum, who's in Trondheim, Norway, it's always nice to hear from the international contingent, suggests that we should celebrate by me walking through all of London. Oh, wait. So I am being trolled by people in Norway now. Like, this is the thing about social media, is there are people in completely different countries who know enough about me that they feel it's okay to randomly troll my leisure habits.
To be fair, John, being a person who is trolled is part of your online identity.
I mean, that is true.
And
yeah.
You have made your at mentions bed, and now you have to lie in it.
One quite popular suggestion was that we do a drunk episode.
We could do a drunk episode.
We could do a drunk episode where we just start drinking and see how it goes.
Another suggestion from Sarah, who's at Sarah_skis, is to do a musical episode. So maybe we could combine these and drink for so long it becomes a musical episode.
Stop us before we sing again.
See you next week.